Good afternoon, and thank you to everyone joining us throughout the Commonwealth. I imagine that many of you, like me, have been watching the confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the Supreme Court. Fortunately, and as a result of borderline divine inspiration, this afternoon's discussion overlaps nicely with the Senate Judiciary Committee's scheduled lunch break. I'll begin by saying that this has certainly been a difficult year for everyone, the Federalist Society included. As we open this fourth annual Kentucky Chapters Conference, albeit a bit differently than we are used to, I want to thank Lisa Izell and Jenny Mahoney and all of the folks at FedSoc Nationals, along with all the officers for the Lexington Lawyers Chapter for making this event possible. This truly would not have happened this year without such tireless dedication. We are very excited about the next 2 days and the spirited discussion and debate that FedSoc members have grown to expect from this conference. I can assure you that this year is no different in this respect, and we've compiled some truly distinguished guests and some familiar faces who are prepared to discuss some of the emerging legal issues before our state and country. This afternoon, I'm honored and privileged to introduce our first distinguished guest. Daniel Cameron is the 51st Attorney General for the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and he is the first African-American independently elected to statewide office in Kentucky's history. Mr. Cameron is an Elizabethtown native, graduating from John Hardin High School. He attended the University of Louisville, where he played football and later graduated from the Louis D. Brandeis School of Law. After graduation, he completed a federal judicial clerkship. Prior to his election, Mr. Cameron served as legal counsel to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, where he assisted and participated in the successful confirmation of several federal judges, including Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch. From 2017 to his election, Mr. Cameron practiced law at Frost Brown Todd in their Louisville office, and he has also served as spokesman for the Kentucky Smart on Crime Coalition. Please join me in welcoming Kentucky's Attorney General, Daniel Cameron.
Good afternoon. It is a pleasure to be with you today to kick off this conference and to discuss significant legal issues facing our communities, our Commonwealth, and ultimately our nation. First, I'd like to thank Tom and the other officers of the Central Kentucky Chapter of the Federalist Society, including Carmine Icarino, Leslie Bilby, Aubrey Travis, and Brett Nolan, for the invitation to join you today and for their work to organize the Federalist Society Kentucky Chapter's annual conference. I'd also like to thank the Federalist Society National, especially Lisa Izell and Jenny Mahoney for your work in presenting programming that fosters the exchange of competing ideas and welcomes debate. Although this conference looks different and we are holding it virtually, I still consider it an honor to be in the company of attorneys across the Commonwealth who are dedicated to furthering the principles embodied in our Constitution. Since its inception, in 1982, the Federalist Society has stood as a beacon for the rule of law and adhering to the foundational premise, and I quote, "It is emphatically the province and duty of judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be." I'm grateful for their efforts to keep these issues at the forefront. This afternoon, I want to talk about an issue with far-reaching implications for all of us. In light of these unprecedented times, it is an issue, in my judgment, that should occupy the minds of attorneys across the Commonwealth and our nation. It is a matter of individual rights and liberties in the midst of public health emergencies. When I was sworn into office only 10 months ago, no one could have predicted how the COVID-19 pandemic would affect our communities and our economy. Most people didn't even know of the existence of this virus, but this global health crisis has changed nearly every aspect of our lives and raised important legal issues we must now confront. For nearly 7 months, we have collectively adapted to what some are describing as a new normal without a foreseeable end in sight. And many of us have been forced to consider how we balance the need for public health while protecting individual rights in times of an enduring health crisis. This question is not limited to attorneys. It is a question that all Kentuckians must ask ourselves as we go about our day-to-day lives. In an effort to protect public health, businesses, schools, and churches have been shuttered. We've seen the economy of our Commonwealth crippled by orders restricting travel, limiting public gatherings and businesses, including daycares and restaurants, and unemployment rates have risen to highs not seen since the Great Depression. Even spaces designated as public forums, like the Kentucky State Capitol, where I work, have been closed to our citizens. At the outset of the pandemic, attorneys general across the country, including myself, responded to this health crisis by focusing on the current case law relating to the Constitution, personal liberty, and public health emergencies. As we have grappled with these issues, the role and implication of Jacobson v. Massachusetts has resurfaced. Those of you familiar with the Supreme Court case dating back to 1905 will remember that the court upheld a Massachusetts statute empowering municipal boards of health to require all residents to receive a smallpox vaccination. When Mr. Jacobson, a resident of Cambridge, refused to comply with the mandate, the city prosecuted him. Jacobson, in turn, argued that the city violated the rights afforded to him by the Constitution. Many of our contemporaries have sought to use this case as a means to justify exceedingly broad actions taken by states to restrict personal liberty and free exercise of religion during the pandemic. They argue that Jacobson permits a state to lawfully execute their broad police powers to react to emergencies related to health and safety, regardless of whether constitutional rights are affected. In contrast to those opinions, careful review of the Supreme Court's decision in Jacobson has led me in this office to a different conclusion. Although the Jacobson Court recognized a state's latitude in times of crisis, it also provided a starting point from which to determine whether a public health measure has overstepped state authority and violated the Constitution. In the final words of the opinion, the court indicates that this power may be taken too far by stating that the police power of a state, whether exercised directly by the legislature or by a local body acting under its authority, may be exerted in such circumstances or by regulations so arbitrary and oppressive in particular cases as to justify the interference of the courts to prevent wrong and oppression. It's also important to note that Jacobson did not arise in the context of restricting fundamental First Amendment rights, like the free exercise of religion and free speech and assembly. Justice Alito's dissent, joined by Justices Thomas and Kavanaugh in Calvary Chapel Dayton Valley versus Sisolak, also takes issue with any interpretation of Jacobson, allows governors or public officials carte blanche to disregard the Constitution for as long as the medical problem persists. Justice Alito writes, "We have a duty to defend the Constitution, and even a public health emergency does not absolve us of that responsibility." General Bill Barr, no stranger to this group, has expressed a similar sentiment in an April 27th memo to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights and all United States attorneys. He wrote, "The Constitution is not suspended in times of crisis." He followed that by saying, "We must therefore be vigilant to ensure its protections are preserved at the same time as the public is protected." So as this office considered our role in protecting public health and respecting the rights of Kentuckians, we did what any of you would have done. We consulted the text. We looked at the Constitution. In my judgment, it is understandable and necessary for states at times to enact more restrictive guidelines early in a public health emergency due to the uncertainty of the situation and the need to act quickly to address a growing crisis. However, as time passes, it is only reasonable to expect restrictions to loosen in step with medical and scientific knowledge. It is paramount that public health measures simultaneously respect a citizen's constitutional rights and safeguard public health. To that end, as Attorney General, I've been working on behalf of Kentucky citizens and businesses to ensure that our Constitution and the laws of our Commonwealth are followed. Over the last several months, We filed 4 amicus briefs in the Sixth Circuit to support the constitutional rights of Kentuckians to practice religion as they please. In Roberts v. Neese and Maryville Baptist v. Bashir, the Sixth Circuit issued unanimous rulings allowing Kentuckians first to attend drive-in services and then in-person services, as long as social distancing guidelines were followed. The court's ruling rightly reflect the value our founders had for the exercise of religion when it stated, "While the law may take periodic naps during a pandemic, we will not let it sleep through one." Tellingly, the Sixth Circuit's ruling in these cases were decided on back-to-back Saturdays, just before Sunday worship services in the Commonwealth. We've also participated in other lawsuits to ensure the rights of Kentuckians and Kentucky businesses are respected. In July, we joined a Boone County Circuit Court lawsuit brought by several Northern Kentucky businesses challenging the constitutionality of the governor's use of executive power during this pandemic. Just a month ago, our office presented oral arguments before the Supreme Court of Kentucky in this case, and we currently await the court's ruling. Our office also recently joined a lawsuit brought by Ag Commissioner Ryan Quarles and a small business, Evans Orchard, in Scott County Circuit Court. This lawsuit challenges the process used by the governor to issue executive orders halting the operations of Kentucky businesses during COVID-19. As the chief legal officer for the Commonwealth, I will continue to work on behalf of Kentuckians to ensure our laws and Constitution are followed. It is my responsibility to raise these issues, and I do so with the sole intent of fulfilling my duty to uphold the law. Kentucky's Constitution first makes mention of the office of the Attorney General as a position in 1792. Since that time, there have been 51 individuals bestowed with the privilege of holding this office. Each one of us has left some imprint of what the Constitution refers to as the Department of Law. Although very early in my tenure, I've already been given one opportunity to make a lasting impact on this office by establishing the Office of Solicitor General. And believe it or not, the tiny seed to establish a robust appellate practice to meet the needs of this new decade was planted at the 2017 convening of this conference. After listening to Albert Lin, the former Solicitor General of West Virginia, talk about the importance of the Office of the Solicitor General in state and national legal discourse, it was then that I decided that if I was ever fortunate enough to sit in this seat, that I would incorporate the office of the Solicitor General. In this last legislative session, the General Assembly codified the Solicitor General's role, making it a permanent addition to the office of the Attorney General and ensuring that the constitutionality of our laws will be defended by the Attorney General now and into the future. With Chad Meredith, Matt Kuhn, and Jeff Cross at the helm, over the last 10 months, our office has intervened in dozens of lawsuits in the defense of the laws passed by our General Assembly, including pro-life statute, workers' compensation laws, zoning ordinances, and many others. We've also led the filing of amicus briefs in support of cases before the United States Supreme Court. Recently, we filed a friend of the court brief on behalf of several secretaries of state, including Kentucky's own Secretary of State, Michael Adams. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear this case to weigh in on the scope of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. As our nation's highest court is the news of the day right now, as Tom alluded to earlier, I'd be remiss if I didn't pause for a moment to comment on the ongoing confirmation process of Judge Amy Coney Barrett. During my time as legal counsel to the Majority Leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, I was grateful to take part in the successful confirmation of federal judges, including Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch. And like many of you, I look forward to what we hope will be a successful confirmation of another United States Supreme Court originalist and textualist in Judge Barrett. Because the judiciary's role in our lives is ever increasing, nominations of judicial candidates like Judge Barrett, who demonstrate reasonable and sound legal jurisprudence, become all the more important because they are committed to adhering to the Constitution and upholding the rule of law. 2020 has certainly been an interesting year, and there is no doubt that it has presented unprecedented challenges for all of us. In the midst of navigating these challenges, I am thankful for the steady hand of the Federalist Society, and I am thankful for your continued work to foster debate and discussion of critical legal issues. While we do not know what the remaining months of 2020 and the upcoming year will hold, I can promise you that regardless of the circumstances, my office remains committed to working on behalf of Kentuckians to uphold our laws and Constitution. Together, with your help, I'm confident that we can emerge from this pandemic stronger than ever before. Thank you. God bless.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General, for those remarks. They're obviously very topical and important. They'll be playing a role in both this upcoming panel and the panel set for 6 o'clock tonight, directly addressing the pandemic and its impact on constitutional law.